Welcome to Tangible Remnants, the podcast that makes adaptive reuse exciting, accessible, and sustainable for every building owner. I'm Nikita Reed, an architect and a champion of reusing existing buildings. I'm excited that you're here, so let's get into it. Welcome back. So, did you know that every building over six stories tall in New York City needs a checkup every 5 years? And it's all about keeping things safe and sound. In today's episode, I chat with Tiffany Simple, a preservation architect making an impact in New York. She shares her experiences working with the Landmarks Preservation Commission, historic districts, and delves into how these districts can sometimes lead to unexpected changes in communities. I met Tiffany over 15 years ago when we were both students in UPenn's Historic Preservation Program. Now, she's the principal and owner of Simple Design Studio Architects, PC. She's a registered architect in New York and New Jersey and a qualified exterior wall inspector in New York City. She has extensive experience in architectural preservation and has worked on a range of projects involving various construction typologies, materials, and finishes. Her expertise includes preservation planning, adaptive reuse, and community engagement, notably contributing to historic civil rights sites and cultural heritage projects throughout North America, the United Kingdom, and the Caribbean. Since you're listening to this podcast, you know that preservation is about more than just bricks and mortar. And Tiffany knows this too. As a minority female architect in preservation, she is dedicated to advocating towards a more inclusive industry. She's an active member in several professional organizations, including the Association of Preservation Technologies, APT, where she is the co-chair of the Inclusion Advocacy Committee and is part of several advocacy organizations within the industry. She's also part of the National Organization of Minority Architects and the International Council on Monuments and Sites, also known as ICOMOS. It was really great to catch up with Tiffany, and I'm excited for you to hear the various stories that she tells. Before we jump in, reminder to sign up for my newsletter to get access to industry insights, resources, and events. You can opt in via the show notes for this episode or by going to nikitareed.com. That's NAKITAREED.com. All right. Without further ado, please enjoy this conversation between me and Tiffany Simple. Well, Tiffany, thank you so much for joining me on the show. And I'm excited to talk to you, particularly because you are a preservation architect who's working in New York. And I always think of New York as like the mecca of historic and tall buildings and all of the assessments and things that need to happen. So I guess, why don't we start with, what do you usually tell someone when they come to you with a historic building that they want to do something with?
Great question. So as you kind of mentioned, New York is huge. There's a lot of different ordinances that kind of interplay with each other and sometimes against each other. In particular, the city, we have one of the biggest facade ordinances in the country, which is basically any building, whether it's a landmark building, a historic building, any building that is over six stories has to be inspected every 5 years. So that already kind of like brings the owner in to know that they have to maintain their building for public safety. So that's kind of like one large area of work that kind of drives the city and the repair and rehab sector as far as we go, which is called local law. Everyone's very aware, and a lot of times it's a pain to owners, of course, but it kind of keeps things in check. So as far as that goes, those buildings have to be inspected every 5 years. So on a five-year cycle, the buildings have to be inspected visually and up close. We have to put our hands on the building to feel out the materials, make sure everything's actually stable, and then we put together basically items that have to be repaired within a certain time frame. So for buildings that are over that, you know, they kind of already, you know the ropes in terms of what's mandated and what's mandatory for them to be in compliance.
Then do those reports have to go to the city, or like who gets the reports every 5 years?
Yep, they have to get filed with the Department of Buildings. Yeah. And they have to sign off on these reports as well. So although we do our due diligence, they are coming out themselves and checking and making sure that they agree with what we've stated.
Which is, I can imagine, a lot of work, but also I'm glad to know that that's in place, particularly knowing there's a lot of people. And if building materials start falling off of buildings in the city, people are going to die. So I'm glad that there is this ongoing maintenance report happening.
Absolutely. Especially, you know, with historic terracotta. That's kind of one material that they focus primarily on because there have been so many failures, you know, with like the structural components corroding. It kind of doesn't really a lot of times give any indication that it's going to fail. So that's why they really try to push these things. You know, if there's something that can't be visually detected, we kind of have other alternatives to check that out.
Gotcha. And so then aside from facade maintenance, what are some other things that people often come to you for?
So aside from facade maintenance, obviously New York City also has the largest Landmarks Preservation Commission in the country. So we were the first ones, and we have the most designated properties and districts in the country. So
wow.
Even though you're not over six stories, you know, chances of you being in a landmark district are very high. So we have a lot of owners who, you know, just doing typical maintenance. If they're a landmark building, you know, that also has to go to then Landmarks Preservation Commission for their review and approval. So that's another kind of agency review process that we are very familiar with. We do a lot of work with properties, you know, something as simple as placing railings, doing your sidewalk, like kind of gets looped into that. And then we also have building owners who are typically our favorite, the ones that don't have to do anything but really want to. So we actually have a building that we just started working on the Lower East Side, and it's an amazing building, a very historic building. Somehow is not a landmark, but the owner really wants to do right. They're very proud of their structure. Five-story building as well, so it doesn't fall under local law. But we actually just had some meetings with them, and they're going to be reinstating a historic cornice that was previously removed after we showed them like the historic images that we were able to find in archives and stuff. So those projects are always super exciting.
It's awesome. It's interesting to hear that there are so many historic districts. I didn't realize there were like that many overlap being one, but that makes a lot of sense. I mean, it is New York City. Are there any sort of downsides of being in some of the historic districts or even getting buildings nominated or trying to update some of the nominations within the historic districts?
Yeah, there. I mean, this is always a tricky question as a, you know, preservation architect like us. I did quite a lot of research a few years ago, basically kind of looking at the effects of historic districts. And I focused on LPC throughout New York, like Harlem, Brooklyn, and some others, just to kind of look at how some of the historic districts eventually led to gentrification. Obviously not intentionally, obviously not as a stab to preservation. We love what we do. But just kind of looking at steps that LPC takes in terms of policy and, you know, after that, kind of like the lack of educational programs to people to be, you know, familiar with grants and things like this to upkeep their properties instead of like selling to the highest bidder, thinking that they have to put so much work into these structures just because they're then nominated. So that is definitely one large aspect that I personally did for a while when working at other firms and now are doing at my firm, is to kind of educate people in lower income communities that are within a historic district to kind of show them all of the policies that are in place and great programs and kind of goals of historic districts and what they can take advantage of in terms of restoring their properties and keeping their properties up to code, especially with any additions or modifications and things of that nature. And kind of just reminding people that just because your building has been nominated doesn't mean that it's the end of the world or the government is now in control of your building more than you as the owner.
Yeah, that's definitely something that I've been seeing sometimes of our clients as well, where there's kind of that misunderstanding of what it means to have a historic building, or thinking that, oh, well, if my building's historic, then I can't do this to it, or I can't do that to it, or the government's going to take it. And so really working to help educate and demystify what it means to have a historic building, what you're allowed to do with it. And so I'm curious kind of where you are. So I know every jurisdiction, every historic district has different requirements and their purview in terms of it's just exterior, interior. And so I'm curious from kind of different historic districts in New York, is it really kind of exterior purview, or are there also some interior purview that the historic districts have control over as well?
So usually the interiors are a separate listing. So when we're talking about like just historic districts, those are looking at properties, you know, that are significant as a whole, whether it's for architectural reasons, social reasons, anything like that in the past, that would be kind of nominated in the historic nomination form. So that will be indicated. And then separately, if there's, say, a theater or something, a historic theater within like a larger district, that would be also individually nominated. So when you're within a district, you can be listed as a significant building or a contributing building. And so that's a kind of like the larger distinctions. And then usually you have a lot more flexibility if you're just a contributing building to a district, mm-hmm. as opposed to being like one of the focal buildings of that district. If you're one of the focal buildings or you're an independent landmark instead of just being within a district, then a lot of times they have separate interior nominations if it's something significant to be preserved. But again, those have to be listed separately or indicated kind of in that listing.
Gotcha. That makes sense. Yeah, it's interesting to me how every jurisdiction, it's similar but different enough where it's like working with a local professional who actually understands the ins and outs of the system makes a big difference. Yeah, because if I was ever to do any work in New York, I would definitely call you to be like, hey, Tiffany, what's the process to get through this? Because like, I know what it is in Maryland and DC and Virginia.
Right.
But New York's a whole different situation.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Want to learn more about the unknown ladies of architecture? Then I recommend you listen to She Builds Podcast, where we tell the stories of remarkable women who have shaped the design and construction industries.
Hi, I'm Jessica.
I'm Nurjiti.
And I'm Lizzie.
After we graduated from Syracuse University School of Architecture, we set out to learn and share the untold stories of women that traditional school curriculum left out.
One day, there's an announcement on campus that women had been seen wearing, quote, inappropriate clothing. Gasp!
What the heck does that mean?
Yeah, so it turns out that Ruth and her fellow classmates were these women. They had field classes where they're doing welding, forging, and foundry work, and obviously they have to wear jeans to those classes instead of, like, dresses or whatever else.
While Gertie was in school, she wasn't just going to classes, trying to stay alive like some of us. I know that was me in school, just taking it day by day.
Yes.
But not Gertie. She became the president of EVIGOL, an honorary association of Cornell women architects.
Of course she did.
These are stories not taught in schools. Women who've molded the world of architecture, construction, and development for over a century.
From Jane Jacobs to Ray Eames, She Builds Podcast explores the legacies of trailblazers. Subscribe now on your favorite podcast platform.
Let's fill the gaps in history together. All you have to do is follow the link in the show notes and subscribe and be part of a movement to expand industry narratives.
And so then, and also, I love that the work that you're doing at Simple Design Studio is educating building owners who may be people of color or owners in areas that are considered lower income. So they have a better understanding of the historic constraints and protections on their building. Was SDS outreaching to the community, and what is that looking like?
Yeah, so just some background. This is our fifth year at SDS. Initially, when we started, I think that, you know, based on people who came to us or who we reached out to for work, if we kind of knew their situation, we would price our proposals accordingly. And that was kind of always, you know, like an internal, no, whatever. We didn't tell them, oh, we're giving you this discount. You know, it wasn't anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
But this year, we didn't really have any incoming projects that we were like, oh, we really should do like a reduced fee-based something. So we decided to launch what we called the Equity and Preservation Initiative, which was basically a call that we put out on social media and to people that we were already in network with to offer reduced fee services. Reinforcing our belief that access to preservation expertise shouldn't be a barrier by any means. So we really, in particular, wanted to reach out to people of underrepresented groups, nonprofits who just didn't have the funding or really needed something done. We've done a lot of work in the past with people just to help them do like the initial stages for them to get grants and things like that. So we put out that call and we're about to start on a project that we awarded to someone last month. So we're excited about that this year.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah, I'm glad that you're offering that service because I think that's the piece also where a lot of times people who aren't in this space, they don't understand, well, what am I paying for? You're not doing any construction. It's like, but there's still the time and the research and the effort to go through and gather all the information to understand the process to go through it. And so the fact that you're making a portion of that work available at a reduced rate, I think that's fantastic. And I know some firms do that. There are some firms that try and do some percentage. A lot of times, like, I think there's this like 1% movement of like donating design work or 1% of like their annual portfolio being donated or something like that.
Yeah.
But a lot of it is just trying to help demystify it, because it is a process. And a lot of times, yes, you are having to pay the professionals to do the upfront work, but we are saving you so much money from not having to do things in the wrong order, because that's what happens. What I've seen often is that first-time project developers do things in the wrong order. They don't know what they're doing per se. They run out of time because they run out of money, and the project stops.
Absolutely.
And the community gets upset because they had all these promises and then the developer disappears. So it's like, how do we help minimize that? So I'm glad that some of the services that you're putting together will help aid in that. I know you also are very involved with APT, or the Association for Preservation Technology, particularly on the Inclusion and Advocacy Committee. Talk to me a little bit about how that started and how that's going.
Yeah. So the Inclusion Advocacy Committee, or IAC for short, which we call it, I actually proposed this committee to the then APT president, and I think it was 2019. And then after like meeting with her a few times and kind of discussing the details and, you know, the need, or my views on the need for the committee, it was actually presented and adopted as a standing committee by the board. So since that time, kind of like its formal induction, I've co-chaired the committee with Ronnie Cameron. I don't know if you know him, but he's fantastic, out of New Jersey, another preservation architect. And basically we are just focused on ensuring that APT and the profession in general, you know, this is really focused on, from their aspect, like the technical aspects of preservation.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of times they feel like, you know, the National Trust handles all of the, I don't want to say intangible aspects of,
right.
They're handling the intangible, we're handling the tangible, and, you know, that's how it's going to be. But it was really necessary, in my opinion, as being one of the few Black females that I see at all of these conferences, events,
mm-hmm.
you know, just for our profession to grow more inclusive and accessible to diverse voices and communities. So that was kind of the background for it. It's been going great. We currently have an equity scholar program, which is done annually for the conference. This is done by sponsoring students and early professionals to attend APT who aren't typically introduced to it or who wouldn't, you know, be able to attend. We do community engagement projects. You helped us with one as well in Anacostia, which unfortunately we had to pause due to some building issues, but that was off to a great start. We also have a great webinar planned for later this year on oral histories, so stay tuned. But we are making movements and also just there as kind of a resource and backdrop for the other standing committees within the organization.
Yeah. I remember we were chatting after one of the presentations you gave on gentrification at, I think, the 2019 conference in Miami.
Yeah, in Miami.
And,
yep.
And then kind of talking about this. And I just remember being so grateful that you were doing this work and sharing it, particularly because so often gentrification is not discussed as openly as it could be, because it's become very much a taboo word. I think you also were bringing this up, was that it's the displacement is the issue, not necessarily better services, better buildings, better spaces. It's like the people who are living there with buildings that are underutilized, they want those buildings to be fully utilized. They just want to be able to still stay in their communities once those buildings are put to good use.
Absolutely. But,
yeah. So it's like, how do we actually do development without displacement? And how do we also help preservationists be a part of the conversation so that we're mindful of the impacts of what we're doing? So I was just so grateful to see that you were bringing that conversation to APT.
Yeah. And obviously I never went into this as like thinking of myself as being like an advocate or anything mm-hmm. in general. It was more of just being like, okay, I am sick of this. And
no right.
like, and it's kind of sad that it comes to that, but there were so many, as you know, just like conflicting conversations and this terrible like dichotomy in the industry that were kind of just like, okay, then I guess it's, you know, it's up to you and I to, you
right.
know, to lead these efforts and do these things. And obviously we still have heated conversations with people
mm-hmm.
who are like, you know, we're talking about repointing a building or like restoring this building. And I think that that's what's been kind of the most rewarding about having my own firm now. And also, you know, being involved with the Inclusion Advocacy Committee is that, you know, we can kind of just encourage people that it's not always just about material-based technical preservation. These places were designed for people.
Yeah, exactly. We're preserving them for people.
Exactly. These are not, you know, preserved to just be artifacts in a museum.
Right.
These are living vessels, so let's treat them as such.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the thing that I also appreciate about it is that APT really is definitely kind of our tribe of people in terms of like, we're the nerds of like, oh, what's happening on that building? Let's talk about the mortar, right? You know what I mean? Like definitely wanting to get into the nitty gritty of the building materials. But I think also being able to tie in kind of the bigger picture to it and helping a lot of our fellow nerds not be so zoomed in that they're forgetting about the people aspect of the building is super important.
And it's also, I mean, not only is it so important, but it's not separate. Like, I feel like everyone's like, you know, this is the building and this is the construction methodology or whatever. And but what they're missing is that, you know, the cultural aspect affects the structural methodology of a lot of these structures. So if we're not looking at that, then we're missing a huge part of what we need to be doing in our preservation work.
Absolutely. And it's like the way to make sure that preservation stays relevant and also that the general public doesn't think that preservation is just about preserving something because some dead old white man slept there. It's like, how do we actually expand the narrative and get more people into the tent? Because a lot of people care about existing in historic buildings, not just the mortar.
Absolutely.
Before we wrap up, why don't we pivot and talk a little bit about some of the projects that you're doing at your company, if there are any that you want to highlight?
Yeah, I would love to. So what's been great about SDS is I'm able to do a lot more of adaptive reuse work now, as well as preservation planning, things like that, which get into looking at more things than just the brick and mortar. So that's been, I think, the most exciting part. One project we worked on last year was in Kinderhook, New York, which is a town south of Albany, New York. And what we kind of reviewed there is the village had a existing historic district, and it was primarily nominated for Dutch colonial architecture because that's what the neighborhood was known for. So we do, you know, all of our archival research to kind of look at how this can be expanded to include more buildings or if it's more narratives or whatever. And we initially go in to look at this. We talked with a few librarians, some archivists, and a few other people. And then we actually got in touch with the African American Association of Columbia County, which kind of gave us some additional information. And the stuff we ended up uncovering was crazy and, you know, nowhere to be found in any of this historic, you know, significance. So this small community originally had one of the highest numbers of enslaved people at one time in the United States. Insane for New York. Yeah. They also had a people of color cemetery, which was kind of nominated separately, but we realized was much larger at the time and now was more than likely under several people's homes.
Wow.
Yeah, it was very interesting. So we were able to kind of make recommendations for this neighborhood to obviously include a lot more narratives and it kind of expand the significance of the district, not only in architectural, but for African-American history, as well as some additional cultural history components. So that was probably one of our most exciting ones over the past year.
Yeah, that's awesome. I mean, if people who have their houses on top of cemeteries, like, oh, well, that explains it. That's what that was. You got ghosts.
And everyone's kind of like, well, we don't really have like the markers. And we're like, this clearly states like how much land at the time was given for this. And you're now down to this. So we can definitely assume that we're in this area right here.
Right. There you go. Dang. Okay. So then what's one tip or one recommendation you would have for someone who is working on adaptively reusing a building?
We are currently working on an adaptive reuse project in upstate New York where we are converting an old huge house and library, which the owner used, and we are converting that into 5 separate apartment units. And I would say following the process of that, dealing with kind of the previous consultant who was on, dealing with SHPO, dealing with owners, I would say my biggest tip is to not get ahead of yourself with what you're recommending to the owners, getting their hopes up about things, making sure that you have checked only with code, with SHPO. A lot of times when you get into historic structures, especially for adaptive reuse, you're kind of pigeonholed into what you can do and what you can't do, what's kind of important to them. And it's kind of important to stay on top of what those key figures are so that you make the appropriate recommendations before you go full steam ahead into new design.
That is such a great recommendation. Because the number of people who are like, oh, I want to do this to the building. It's like, well, actually, that's not going to be allowed.
Oh, yeah. Not even want to do this. But like, I was told I could do this. And kind of like, you have to be the bearer of bad news. Like, me, not happening. Yeah.
Right. Exactly. That's such a good point. Because yeah, the number of people who are like, oh, well, this guy down the street said, it's like, yeah, but he doesn't know what he's talking about.
Yeah. And also, I mean, some things, you know, obviously you have to pick your battles with Shippo. You know, some things they're very open to, others they're, you know, this is something that we will not budge on.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's always a negotiation, but knowing the constraints and the bounds is super important.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much for listening. Links to amazing resources can be found in the episode's show notes. Special thanks to Sarah Gilberg for allowing me to use snippets of her song Fireflies from her debut album, Other People's Secrets, which, by the way, is available wherever music is sold. If you haven't already, be sure to subscribe to the show. And now that Tangible Remnants is part of the Gable Media Network, you can listen and subscribe to all network partner content at gablemedia.com. That's GABLmedia.com. Until next time, remember that historic preservation is a present conversation with our past about our future. We don't inherit the earth from our parents, but we borrow it from our children. So let's make sure we're telling our inclusive history.
I saw the first fireflies of summer, and right then I thought of you. Oh, I could see us catching them and setting them free. Honey, that's what you do. That's what you do to me.